Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Well, look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
You're listening to Film Spotting. Adam Kempinar, Josh Larson, Michael Phillips. We're here attempting to make it through this formidable task of documenting our 10 greatest films ever, of course, inspired by the recent Sight and Sound ballot that comes out every decade. We have 5 picks left, no overlap, so 15 films to highlight. We're also going to get to my conversation with one of our favorite filmmakers here on Film Spotting who had an official ballot, and I'm trying to be a little bit clever and coy and not reveal who it is. I want to build up the suspense a little, Josh. Do you think it's working at all?
Yes. People just can't wait to find out who this is,
which listeners
have a fairly good idea, I think.
It is not Woody Allen. It's also not Michael Fassbender. Not a director, but, you know, that would have been quite a get to have Michael Fassbender chime
who
in.
Who could it be?
I just had to throw his name out there since none of his films made my top 10. We've organized our choices by theme instead of ranking them. Sight and Sound doesn't subject the voters to ranking them, so we didn't subject ourselves to it either. This trio of classics covers movies about the movies.
Moses supposes his toeses are roses, but Moses supposes erroneously.
But Moses, he noses, his toeses aren't roses, as Moses supposes his toeses to be.
Moses supposes his toeses are roses, but Moses supposes erroneously.
A Moses is a mose.
A rose is a rose.
A toes is a toes.
Hoop-de-doody-doodle.
Moses supposes his
one of the all-time great roses, films about Hollywood, Michael, Singing in the Rain.
Oh, I love it. That's the example for me, Adam, of the musical that really didn't have much on its mind in terms of ambition or changing the form. Or, you know, the year before, MGM put out and won the Oscar for An American in Paris, which is a much more openly pretentious and in many ways great musical directed by one of my favorite directors, Vincent Minnelli. Singing in the Rain, the script by Comden and Green, Gene Kelly. It's got a much lighter, less ambitious air to it. It's also the most exuberant and kinetic movie I think ever made. And it's kind of a crock that a movie like The Artist, which I enjoy, wins Best Picture, and Singing in the Rain, chopped livered, never got any serious nomination consideration except for Gene Hagen, I think, getting a nomination for Best Supporting Actress. I adore the film. The only MGM film I like almost as much is The Bandwagon by Minnelli a year later. And it's a picture that, I guess like Citizen Kane, it's been with us and canonized so many decades now that people kind of take it for granted and almost dismiss it without even having seen it lately. I love tap dancing because of that film.
Right.
To me, a film like that is so much more truly, truly inspiring than a movie like Gigi, where there's really kind of no dance on screen of any type. Mm-hmm. It's not about that. But Singing in the Rain, to me, just it's the best of almost everything a musical can give you. Tap dancing, an incredible comedy, just forward motion, insane color schemes. And the fact that Gene Kelly and Stanley Donen didn't kill each other co-directing the thing was amazing. And it's the best Kelly showcase ever. And it is a crock that The Artist won Best Picture, and this thing didn't.
Well, Michael, I was going to say, I like The Artist a lot more than you did, but I think in terms of injustices, the fact is, not only has Singing in the Rain been canonized, it's going to be talked about for the next 50 years. It's still going to be showing up on these lists. I don't think The Artist is going to show up on any Sight and Sound lists in the future. So I think it works out fine for Mr. Kelly and Singing in the Rain.
I think the exuberance that you mentioned of the film is just so irresistible. We were just watching this, again, as a family. My daughter mentioned that they watched the scene of Kelly dancing in the rain in school this past year, and she said all the boys in her class at recess immediately afterwards went out and tried to do that dance. And of course, you know, they're doing that to get laughs and make fun of it. But I think you're also pointing out that a part of them, I'm sure, was just blown away by watching someone do that and wanting to try it. So it's just an infectious film.
I think we should note that your daughters go to the Fame School.
Exactly, exactly.
So that only makes
sense. Maybe takes away from the story a little bit.
Well, we go from Hollywood to Italy, and we advance a few years, just a few, for your pick, Josh, for a movie about movies, though really more a movie about celebrity, even though there is a picture being made in the film, and it is Federico Fellini's La Dolce Vita.
Yeah, I'm glad you couched that because I did try to resist the meta pick here. I have this aversion to movies about movies being canonized because it just feels too insider. But I guess I have to admit this is a little bit of that. Why I did want to put this on the list, though, is it's kind of my rules of the game pick because I feel what I appreciate about both is the clear way they see through the frivolity and the mirth of the decadent class, yet both still acknowledge the allure of that lifestyle. Marcello Mastroianni plays a celebrity journalist who's scurrying around the heels of the rich and famous here, and the way it parallels celebrity worship and religious worship throughout. Remember, the opening shot is of a helicopter towing a statue of Jesus over Rome. The way that the movie does this makes it a prescient precursor to today's celebrity-obsessed culture. The movie is structured as a cyclical journey, so we follow nighttime highs to morning emptiness and then back again. And what it does is leave us with this stark reminder that you can stay up as late as you want, but there's really no cure for the morning.
Well, it's an amazing film, obviously, but you had the right director. You had the right star. I think you have the wrong Fellini film. I think it's actually the movie he made after La Dolce Vita where he really shines. I even like Knights of Cabiria better than La Dolce Vita, too, while we're at it. But I'm going with Fellini's 8.5, and Ebert said 8.5 is the best ever movie made about filmmaking. He's probably right, but to your point about being a little averse to films that are about the filmmaking process, this film is so much more than that, and I think that's why it is such a classic. If it was just the struggle of a director trying to get a film made, it wouldn't be in my top 10, but it's about art, it's about marriage, it's about the cultural institutions we remain shackled to, and it is about a person in this director who wants so desperately to create something truthful, and he wants to be an honest person in his life, even though he's recognized, he's trying to come to terms with the fact that he is a fundamentally flawed and dishonest person. I think that what Fellini does in 8.5 is transform the process of making a movie into an existential crisis. And it's such a surreal dreamscape that you get in this movie. It's one of the things you love about Fellini's later films. What's real? What's daydream? What's nightmare? What's fantasy? Present? Flashback? He really mixes it all up and blends it together so beautifully, not only in the way he uses the camera and editing, but sound is a major part of this film as well. And in terms of the imagery, I talked in part one about looking for films that are transcendent, these moments of ecstasy, of something sublime. There are a few sequences in cinema that take my breath away more than the end parade, the culmination of the film 8.5. I don't know how many directors could dream that up, much less actually pull it off, where we basically see every character from his life, every character from the film come back to this end sequence. It really is not just wonderfully surreal and absurd, but it's the perfect culmination of the film. And that, as I said, is the transcendence I was really looking for with my picks that makes me come back to a movie like 8.5 again and again. So, Michael, I know we disagree a little bit on this. You don't love it nearly as much.
Help me out a little bit here, Michael.
You know, you guys got the wrong Italian. I mean, I think honestly, Fellini, to me, and this is miserably dismissive, but his composer, Nino Rota, is inarguably the greater artist of the two. And I think those movies are basically conduits.
That's a bold statement.
Rota's music is going to, for me, is going to last a lot longer in the cultural memory than Fellini's images, seriously. And I guess I say this because, because I'm a dick. And and secondly, because the film I found myself kind of gravitating toward in making this list, at least in the top 20, would be L'Avventura by Antonioni.
So great film.
That film, I think the mystery and the technique of that picture is a more lingering achievement than Fellini's slightly manic quality, that kind of manic, desperate, comic, outsized quality that people love and got him discovered and adored all over the world. And certainly there are images and sequences in both La Dolce Vita and 8.5 I adore, but I think Antonioni's kind of spare and really desolate depiction of, you know, it's a much harder, harsher, bitter, more bitter pill to take. But I think if you look at L'Avventura and Michael A. Cleese, and the film I like more than most people, actually, Le Note. Mm-hmm. The chill in those movies really sticks in your bones.
Well, there's not an actress I enjoy watching more on screen than Monica Vitti, so you're preaching to the choir with those Antonioni films. But it's interesting, as you talk about that you realize that all three of those films we're talking about, 8 1/2, La Dolce Vita, and La Ventura, are films about alienation and characters who feel cut off from the people around them, but they couldn't be more different in terms of the way Fellini and Antonioni
very much so
handle it.
How much are you worth?
I have no idea. How much do you want?
No, I just want to know what you're worth. Over 10 million?
Oh, my, yes.
Why are you doing it? How much better can you eat? What can you buy that you can't already afford?
The future, Mr. Gitz. The future. Now, where's the girl?
We move from films from the 1950s and 60s to the 1970s. This was a decade, I think it's fair to say, oozing with anti-heroes, which comprises our next theme, our next set of three picks. You can't get much more of a great cinematic anti-hero than Jack Nicholson as Jake Gittes in Chinatown.
I don't have a proper noir on my list, I'm realizing, but I do have Chinatown, which is, of course, an imitation in a lot of ways. But I really feel it's possible that Polanski and screenwriter Robert Towne in particular, in imitating the genre, perfected it along the way. This feels to me, we've used the word perfect a few times, like the most perfect film on the list, in the sense that every word is necessary and it's in its proper place. Watching the plot unfold is a thing of beauty. Even the period details are elegant and precise. And then the cast is just mesmerizing. You've got Faye Dunaway's tragic smolder, Jack Nicholson's bruised gallantry, and lording over both of them, director John Huston, who's just oozing all sorts of corruption. Now, above all of this going on, there still is that air of fatalism, which is what ties it to the original genre for me. The idea that the first film noirs had, that things are going to go badly no matter what. Mm-hmm. And that's what I appreciate about Chinatown, is that it held that essence right up to its very end.
Well, I think, of course, imitation probably really isn't the right word. If anything, it's transforming the genre of film noir. Yes, it has a lot of those elements, but I think it's often labeled as a neo-noir, but they really are taking those elements and throwing a lot of them completely on their heads, right down to having an anti-hero like Jake Gittes in that lead role. I love Chinatown. This was such a hard pick to leave off. Another hard pick for me to omit was, Michael, your anti-hero selection. You're going with Martin Scorsese, Robert De Niro, sticking with the 70s.
Yes, Taxi Driver for me is Scorsese's masterwork, and it certainly warps the definition of anti-hero straight into psychosis.
Right.
And one of the reasons I love the film is it continues to divide audiences and defy an easy response to Travis Bickle's behavior. It's also just a film that, like most great, truly great classics, I think, in any genre, you have three or four auteurs struggling for dominance in this picture. You have a really terrific screenplay by Paul Schrader. You have Scorsese, you have De Niro, and you have Bernard Herrmann's final completed musical score, which in many ways doesn't necessarily fit the vibe of the picture, because it's such a throwback to a heavily romanticized view of New York, in that sort of lonely, forlorn saxophone theme that we know is the main theme to Taxi Driver. And Herman's got a very melodramatic streak in his scoring for some of the scare moments, where it's like two different styles of filmmaking kind of clashing. But that there's great energy in that, and it's De Niro's best performance. I just think the last minute of it. Every time I get email from people saying, you're misreading the film, he's a hero, he's my vigilante hero, I like him more than Chuck Bronson in Death Wish. And I just say, I would instruct you, sir or madam, to read, what Paul Schrader, the screenwriter, said. He says, he's going to kill again. He will kill again.
I think you see it in that final moment.
In the final moment in the rearview mirror, and it's brilliantly scored by Herman, and that they reverse the sort of ting a sting, so
yep,
that it actually has this completely creepy reverse, speeded up. And then you're sent out thinking, what about this guy, and what about the city that is actually lying to this guy? As Pauline Kael said, the city's crazier than he is.
Well, you're not going to get me to argue against Taxi Driver. I feel a little bit like a broken record, though, when I say you have the right director, Michael. You have the right star. But
don't
for me,
pick Raging Bull.
I'm going with Raging Bull.
No.
I am going with Raging Bull.
You just can't let us have any of our picks.
No, I can't. I said when extolling the virtues of 8.5 that I loved that end sequence and how much it takes my breath away. Well, another sequence that takes my breath away, though, for a completely different reason, you have a completely different reaction to it than Wonder, is the fight, the final fight with Sugar Ray that is so memorable from Raging Bull. You never got me down, Ray. You never got me down. That mystery of Jake LaMotta, to go with my theme here, is just that overriding desire to punish himself for his sins. And there is a complexity in a character who is clearly his own worst enemy. He is an animal. He is a brute. And he lacks self-control. And he's completely paranoid, as Scorsese shows us. But I think what makes him a tragic and compelling figure is, even with all that being true, his paranoia is ultimately vindicated. And he's hard enough on himself. He's got these internal forces conspiring against him. He also has to contend with all the external forces as well, even if they're external but within his own family. This is a movie that came up 6 years ago or so on the show when Ryan Johnson, the director, sat in and we did an episode where we shared our top five film spotting university movies. Basically, if we were teaching a class and saying these are the five films we think every aspiring filmmaker needs to see, this was one of my movies. And I just think for me, it was the first film that I watched it and said, this is a masterpiece. It's that combination of narrative and technical skill that takes everything to another level. The virtuosity of the camera work and the editing in many sequences, especially though the fight I mentioned with Ray, the slow motion mixed with the quicker cuts, the way sound comes in and out, it all heightens the horror of the film and the boxing scenes, but also adds some kind of odd tone of grace to it all and makes it almost like a ballet. So for me, Raging Bull is the Scorsese film that stands
out
the most.
It's definitely the most conscious masterpiece he ever attempted. And the film is beautiful. And I have seen it several times. It's not a hard film to revisit because it is so crafty the way Scorsese films each boxing sequence in a different style and, in a sense, in a different homage to a different film. I mean, you have parts of the setup. You have all kinds of, you know, body and soul, all kinds of things. It is absolutely fluid and pristine as cinema that way, Adam. I don't know if it's got half of the juice and the real provocation of something like Taxi Driver. Hmm. For me, you know.
No, I think you make a compelling case, and both films are absolute masterpieces. So, like I said, I'm not going to really argue too strongly against Taxi Driver in this case. Well, we've talked about some great screen antiheroes, and you can't talk about antiheroes in cinema without mentioning Paul Newman. Enough teasing here, guys. Let's get to it. Someone who certainly had Paul Newman in mind, consciously or not, when filling out his official Sight and Sound list was Jeff Nichols, the writer-director of Shotgun Stories and one of the best films of last year, Take Shelter. I had the pleasure to talk with Nichols recently about his ballot, which included four Paul Newman movies, also had Lawrence of Arabia, Badlands, Jaws, North by Northwest, and one really unconventional choice that not one other critic or filmmaker voted for.
I finally sat down and wrote it out with the understanding, I guess, with myself that it's kind of up to critics to pick, like, the best movies of all time. That's not really my job, you know. I just make movies. It's up to critics to decide whether or not they like them and if they get where they go and how long they stay. But for me, I just thought about films that had a personal impact on me and really on, I guess, my career, mm-hmm. if you want to say it like that. Really, it's just who I am and who I am as a storyteller and everything else. And with that in mind, I kind of set out to make my list. So you might get some things on there that people say, that's not the greatest movie of all time. And it's like, well, that's not really, I wasn't trying to line up with some universal truth in terms of film. That's up to you guys. For me, I just tried to talk about what had an impact on me.
I think one of the things that stands out with your list, looking at it immediately, is you recognize that four of the 10 films on your ballot star Paul Newman. Cool Hand Luke, The Hustler, Hud, Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. Obviously, that's an actor that had a major impact on you. You certainly enjoyed watching his films. Talk about that decision to include four of his movies.
You know, and it's funny because I don't think of those just as Paul Newman films. Mm-hmm. It's not why I was attracted to him. It's not like I saw one and went out searching others. But I would hope that my case probably line up with Paul Newman's when it comes to the projects he picked. I think there was something really exciting happening in film, especially in his earlier career. When you look at films like The Hustler and Hud, it goes beyond just one actor. It's like what actually was happening in cinema was pretty interesting. And it has a direct parallel with what was happening in acting. You know, you were getting away from stagier kind of cliched acting and people were getting into more serious dramatic stuff. And I think, you know, you always hear about Brando and everybody always talks about Brando, but I feel like Newman was the one who was doing the work that for me felt most honest and most accessible at the same time. And for whatever reason, those films I just really responded to. You know, I grew up with Cool Hand Luke on TV, so you never really appreciate it too much until you revisit it. And when I did revisit it, you know, after film school and after I started making films, you just realize there's a massive amount of artistry in that film, and it's just really easy to watch. It's really compelling. And,
yeah.
And the same goes for all those movies. You know, they strike this balance of like artistic credibility, I suppose, or just they're very artfully made, but they're also just extremely easy to absorb and take in. And, and they just kind of take you through, even with The Hustler, you know, which is a tough movie. It's just kind of effortless the way that narrative kind of unfolds. So in part, you know, it's just by chance that Paul Newman's in all of these films in my top 10, but it's also, there's no chance at all. I think it was just part of what was happening in cinema, you know, he carried that throughout his career.
Yeah. And a lot of those films too, of course, Newman is this anti-hero type figure. He's someone who isn't necessarily the most sympathetic hero, which is something else that makes him really fascinating.
Sarah, you think I'm a loser?
A loser?
Yeah. I met this guy, Gordon, Bert Gordon. He said I was a born loser.
Would he know?
He knows a lot.
Why did he tell you?
I don't know. I'm not sure. So there are people who want to lose, who are always looking for an excuse to lose.
What does he do, this Bert Gordon?
He's a gambler.
Is he a winner?
Well, he owns things.
Is that what makes a winner?
Well, what else does?
Does it bother you what he said?
Yeah. Yeah, it bothers me a lot.
Looking over your list, too, I noticed that they're all English language. You only had one non-American film, Lawrence of Arabia. I'm certainly not trying to make you apologize for that in any way. What I am curious about, though, is when you discovered these films, and you talked about that a little bit, that you watched Cool Hand Luke growing up, but overall, when did you really discover these films? Was it something that you started to appreciate them watching them on TV, or was it later in life when you were seeing yourself as maybe a filmmaker that you started to notice these films? And why did they have such an impact on you versus Fellini or Kurosawa or Bergman?
And there's one Kurosawa film that should be on there that's not, but I left it off mainly because, I don't know, it just didn't, it hasn't directly affected narrative the same way, but Dreams by Kurosawa was something I saw in 11th grade and was pretty blown away by. It should probably be on the list.
Really?
I don't know. It's funny. I really didn't even think in terms of like, oh, what do I have on there? I mean, I made sure I had a Spielberg film on there. I made sure I had a Hitchcock film on there, and I made sure I had a John Ford film on there. You know, but you could pick a range of films from each of those filmmakers. You know, Close Encounters like has had a bigger impact on Take Shelter than Jaws has, but I felt like Jaws had a bigger overall impact in terms of the way I deal with camera and the way I move camera, and there's certain scenes from that movie that I play for people all the time. And I'm like, this is the way I think camera should move in relation to character and everything else. But yeah, each film came into my life at a different time. I've got a story for each, and I won't bother you with each. But, you know, like Badlands is a perfect example. I was in film school and they had a 35mm print and screened it one night. Had no clue, no concept. But I was fairly film illiterate, you know, when it came to going into school. I'd just seen everything that would come through, you know, the multiplex in Arkansas. I'd seen twice, probably, multiple times. And or anything that had come on television. And I really hadn't started to get into the concept of independent filmmaking or foreign films or anything like that until I really got into college. It was just on the tail end of high school that Tarantino was coming out, and even just the concept of it started to enter the public consciousness. And, you know, I walked into a theater not knowing who Terrence Malick was, not knowing anything about this film, and watched Badlands. And I just immediately went home and called my brother, Ben. And I was just like, you got to see this movie. There's this guy. And I mean, like, he kills these people, but I don't know. It's kind of funny in parts, and it's beautiful and lyrical. And he has this comb at the end, and he's just giving this comb away to these National Guard guys. I remember trying to explain that scene to my brother, and he was just like, yeah, all right, I'll check it out.
Kit went to sleep in the courtroom while his confession was being read, and he was sentenced to die in the electric chair. On a warm spring night, 6 months later, after donating his body to science, he did.
Sir? Where'd you get that hat?
State.
Boy, like to buy me one of them.
You're quite an individual, kid.
Think I'll take that into consideration?
Yeah, you know, it's just a film strikes you, and the reason why it stays on this list or makes this list is because it stays with you.
Yeah.
It just doesn't leave, you know? And I guess that's a determining factor, is like how these things just stay with us. And I've always been striving to make films that at least stick with you a couple days, you know?
Yeah.
Because there's so many movies you go see, and an hour later, you're just on to something completely different. And someone would have to ask you what you did that day to even remember that you saw a movie. You know, there's so many films like that. And trying to figure out the alchemy that goes into making a film that doesn't feel so fleeting is, I don't know, it's kind of my mission, I guess, in life. And Badlands was certainly one of those. But each of these films was like that. You know, but Jaws, I watched growing up, and I saw Jaws every weekend at a friend's house, you know, and we fast forward the VHS tape to the part to where the, you know, decapitated head floats out, and we were scared every time. And that film, though, that took making movies to go back and understand why I liked that movie so much. You know, I knew I liked that movie and I knew it had an impact on me, but the way Spielberg moves camera is just, it's perfect in that film. And, you know, but there's also, like, it's not even just about camera movement. Like, there's a beautiful scene there where he has his son at the table and the son's mimicking what he's doing at the table. You know, it's like, those are the kind of moments you want to put on film, you know? And so I think it would be a disservice to Jaws to say it's just about camera movement as well. You know, it does a lot of things.
Yeah. It's interesting. You talked a little bit about the impact they had on you in terms of your career or how you approach storytelling. It certainly didn't surprise me when I first saw your list that the person who made Shotgun Stories and Take Shelter would be so enamored with these films, some of these films that we've touched on, because your movies are very much about working class people who seem very tied to their regions, and that geography plays a major role, and they're very specific, and yet at the same time feel more mythically American. Certainly Badlands fits into that, Cool Hand Luke and HUD. So I wasn't surprised by any of your picks. I think the one that does stand out a little bit, and look, I can sit here all day. We could spend this entire phone conversation just probably exchanging lines of dialogue from Michael Ritchie's Fletch.
Yeah.
It's probably the movie I've seen more than any other film in my life, and that's just a fact. But it probably does stand out to most people a little bit on a list of the greatest films ever. Why does the Chevy Chase comedy Fletch stand out for you?
Well, I'll get into the specifics in a second, but one reason why I included it on the list was because I figured nobody else would, and that's bullshit. Oh, I don't know if I can say that on the radio. Because, like, look, just like you say, we can quote every word of that movie. So why doesn't it make it on these lists?
Right.
You know, nobody ever puts it on these lists, you know? I think everybody is trying to be really smart and sound really intelligent, and they're afraid of not just comedies, but they're afraid, I don't know, they're afraid of a movie like that that's so lodged into pop culture. But when I sat down and I really thought about movies that I've seen over and over and over and over and over again, Fletch was kind of at the top of the list, you know. Goodfellas was on there too, but it was simply because we had two DVDs in our house my junior year of college, and one was Fletch and one was Goodfellas, and I just watched them over and over again. But really, when you look at Fletch, now to get to, like, the serious part of it, like, when you look at Fletch and when you look at Michael Ritchie's films, like, the guy just nails it, and he's able to do it in this, people sound like they're supposed to sound, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Like, sure, Chevy Chase's character is throwing out all this wit with every other line, but it's like, I don't know, it feels honest to me for whatever reason.
Yeah.
I mean, the Michael Ritchie film that I didn't put in there was, and I can never remember the title exactly, but The Incredibly True Confessions of a Teenage Cheerleader Murdering Mom.
Right.
I mean, that film, like, this guy was paying attention. This guy wasn't just making one-off comedies,
right?
You know? And that same intelligence that went into that film obviously went into Fletch.
Drop your shorts and bend over, Mr. Babar.
Oh, no, really, we don't need to. We don't want to do that.
Say, you know, my kidneys feel a lot better in this position. Maybe it's just that I'm not doing any calisthenics. You know, if I did some sit-ups in the morning or bent over like this, I'd probably feel 100% better. Moon River. Whew. Thank you, Doc. You ever serve time?
Breathe easy.
I mean, it's just every day of my life I quote Fletch.
I love it because I do too. I seriously do. And, you know, of course, most of the time people look at me like I'm absolutely insane. But It's just a fact. It's so ingrained in my brain.
It's there, you know. It's there. I just put up a basketball goal for our son, and it's just like he draws the foul.
He draws the foul.
Like every time, it's funny to me. And my wife just looks at me. Like, what are you talking about?
6'9" with the afro.
No, you know, yeah, exactly. It's just I felt like, well, it kind of takes the piss out of the kind of like these lists for one, but also it's just honest. Like it's just true. It's just me being honest with everybody and saying like, look, I've probably watched this movie more than Badlands. In fact, I know I have.
Right.
I know I have. You know, so I don't know. I have to be accountable for that.
Well, I love it. I wish I had your courage and your conviction to put Fletch in my top 10. Unfortunately, it's not going to make it. I guess I do have to put you on the spot a little bit. You've gotten very specific about some of these titles and why they stand out for you. But we did ask all of our special guests on this show to pick the one. I hate to make you pick the one, but the most essential of those 10 films, the one for you, however you define essential, the movie you just can't imagine living without, can't imagine not having seen and drawn some inspiration from, which one is it?
I'd have to say Cool Hand Luke is the most kind of all-encompassing for me. It's impossible to pick, and every day and every project and every scene and every scenario that you encounter as a filmmaker, there are different films you can point to for inspiration, but kind of the most holistic, I would suppose, is Cool Hand Luke. It just kind of does everything I want done in a movie. It gives you an anti-hero. It gives you place. And it gives you humanity in pretty much every scene. And it does it in a way that's not schmaltzy. It's not cheesy. It just does it in a really honest way. And so I don't know. I have to pick. I think I'd have to pick Cool Hand Luke.
That's certainly one I'm not going to argue with. It's an all-time great film. Jeff, it's a real thrill to finally get you on the show. Hopefully we can do this again sometime. Thanks for sharing your insights.
Well, it's a pleasure. Thanks for the support. Talk to y'all later.
I don't care if it rains or freezes, as long as I got a plastic cheese sitting on the dashboard of my car.
My thanks again to Jeff Nichols. It really was a treat to have him on Film Spotting and to talk about some of those films. Very passionate about the movies that had the biggest impact on him. I'm pretty sure he charged that entire phone call to the Underhills. And he might have just ordered a Bloody Mary and a steak sandwich and a steak sandwich.
Can we get some bonus content of the two of you just trading Fletch lines?
I think that should be an entire show.
All right.
Just us quoting Fletch. Jeff Nichols and Adam do Fletch.
That would be great.
I love it.
I think he's actually kind of dodging responsibility there. What does he mean? It's the job of the critics to come up with
these lists. That seems reasonable to me.
But I do understand. And actually, he has some interesting criticism going on there. The Newman-Brando comparison I found really compelling, just comparing their acting styles and how he was able to connect much more with Newman, with what Newman was doing at the time.
Well, I'm sneaking in one of those movies that was just left off my list that I feel bad about, but I'm really glad that he got in some discussion of the movie Badlands. And he talked about that Terrence Malick film and the huge impact it had on him, how he saw it in college and then couldn't stop talking about it. That's a movie I really struggled with for this list. It was initially in my top 10, and only as I started whittling things down did I end up brushing it out. But I can see, as I said in that conversation with him, I can see the influence of movies like Badlands on his list. And I love Cool Hand Luke. I know, Michael, you're not as big a fan as that. You take issue with Jeff Nichols, number one.
I love The Hustler, and I love HUD for different reasons. And I like Cool Hand Luke. I think that's not a, it's just not a film that, to me, is up to that level.
Really?
Yeah. I think the Christ-like parallels are a little ridiculously heavy-handed.
There's no doubt they're ridiculously heavy-handed, and yet I still love it.
Yeah, I mean, I guess maybe I'm just suffering from one too many award shows that worked in that damn Strother Martin failure to communicate line, which to me, it's I never thought I'd get tired of hearing Aretha Franklin sing Respect until the 400th ball game, you know, somewhere in the seventh inning stretch, there it comes again, and I begin to hate it. And it's not the song's fault, you know, but maybe yeah.
It's we'll just worn on you
yes.
a little bit.
Yes.
All
yes.
right. Well, I love Cool Hand Luke, and even though I can quote Fletch more than I can quote Cool Hand Luke, I would put it slightly higher on my list of all-time great films, Josh.
Good to hear. All right, we've only got three picks to go. Is this where one of us goes terribly astray in naming the 10 greatest films of all time? Stay with us.
If I wanted to, I could start over again. Let the good-
decide who she wants me to find. And I'll never let you drop another tear in my eye. Singing, oh, sha-la-la, oh, sha-la-la. Listen, honey, here comes my man. Singing, oh, sha-la-la, oh, sha-la-la. Listen, honey, here comes my man. Yeah.
Well, Josh, we certainly want to thank every listener that's managed to make it up to this point in this epic two-part yes. podcast on our greatest films of all time. We also want to thank everyone who's been so generous as to donate some of their hard-earned dollars to Film Spotting over the past week. This segment, as always, is brought to you by the Q&A with Jeff Goldsmith. This week, he's got episodes live from Comic-Con 2012, TV's Children's Hospital with creator-actor Rob Corddry, and his cast is on the show. And also, of course, don't forget to check out Jeff's new iPad magazine, Backstory. Issue 2 has just been released, and you can get all the information about Backstory at backstory.net. I also do want to make a mention of our featured artist this week. This is a band that's been featured on Film Spotting a couple times before, the Gaslight Anthem. I love this group. That's all I can say. I love the group. I really enjoyed two albums ago, The 59 Sound, and their last one, American Slang, is even better. The new album's out, Handwritten, and I love the song we played in part one, 45. The rest of the album, Josh, is still growing on me.
Got to give it some time.
I got to give it a little bit of time. Right. I'm not sure it's up there with American Slang, but they've turned out two really amazing albums in a row. So I'd forgive them a little bit if this one took a little bit of a dip, but wanted to mention that their new album, Handwritten, is out now. Let's get to our donations. We start with a thank you to a $5 a month donor.
That would be Ben from Chattanooga, Tennessee.
We also want to thank Chris in Pittsburgh, PA, and Daniel in London.
Thank you, Film Spotting, for keeping my girlfriend Laura entertained while I'm on business here in Switzerland. Having discovered the show a few weeks ago, I'm trying my hardest to restrict myself to a show per day from your archives. I have a top five suggestion for you. Top five I Thought You Were Dead movies. Mine would look something like this. 1. Tell No One. 2. The Jacket. 3. La Cara Oculta from 2011. 4. Is Frequency, and his fifth pick is Double Jeopardy. Keep up the fantastic work, and thank you again from myself and my increasingly tolerant partner back in London.
Well, thank you, Dan, and thank you, Laura, for listening. I'm not sure that's a really fruitful top five when you're dusting off The Jacket in Double Jeopardy, but maybe I'm being mean. What do you think?
We could do it. We could probably pull it off.
I'm sure there are other good ones to choose from. Thanks so much for that suggestion, Daniel. We also want to thank Carlos in Chamblee, Georgia.
Your recent top five play adaptations overlook the excellent Equus from 1977, based on Peter Schaefer's play and starring the great Richard Burton. You couldn't even give it an honorable mention?
Couldn't, because to give it an honorable mention, I would need to have seen the movie.
Yeah, I have that requirement too.
Yeah.
So,
we try to stick to that rule that we don't mention the movie. I mean, we break it every now and again, but try to make sure we've actually seen it.
Things we've heard are good.
Right, before we talk about it. And unfortunately, I haven't seen Equus. I know that Daniel Radcliffe recently was in the stage version adaptation of Equus, but I have not had a chance to catch up with that film yet. Carlos, thank you for the push and the donation. Finally, we close with W. Stephen Wright in Parry Sound, Ontario.
This is my first time writing in with my donation. I'm trying to catch up on past episodes, currently on episode 344. I was just wondering if you and Josh are going to be attending TIFF this year. I'm going to be in attendance and was just hoping you guys are organizing a meetup.
So, of course, TIFF being the Toronto International Film Festival.
He's just rubbing it in.
I know, which I attended, I think, 3 years in a row. There was a run 2007, 08, 09. I think I managed to get to those three.
Living the high life.
Huh? I was living the high life, and it's just not going to happen.
It isn't.
It's
I've
really
never
sad.
Been, too.
No, it's really sad because Maddie and I had a blast the last time we were there. We had a meetup with about 20 Film Spotting listeners.
Nice.
And it was really fun. Really good conversation. Plenty of drinks. There was a party going on right across the street. I talked about this on the show, but there was a party for a serious man. A Coen Brothers party going on across the street that we actually somehow had invitations to, but we ended up spending the whole night hanging out with our listeners.
Priorities.
And then one of our friends of the show, Mikado Murphy, works for the New York Times. He was there. He was at the party. And at 1 or 2 a.m., he's like, the Coen brothers are here. What are you doing? You know, get over here. By the time we got over there, they were gone.
Ah, well, time well spent.
I know. It was still an absolute blast to see listeners there. I hope to get back, obviously, to Toronto someday, especially as I missed the special screening of The Master here in 70 millimeter at the Music Box. That is something I really regret, and I know it's playing in 70 mil at Toronto, so that would almost be enough reason to go to Toronto just to see that. But it's just not going to happen. Unfortunately, it just doesn't fit with either of our schedules to make it to that festival. The real tragedy is that there are so many film festivals I'd love to attend. None of them fit well with my schedule.
Yeah, it seems to be a recurring problem.
I've yet to find it. Actually, this time of year, August, early to mid-August, is the slow time of my year. That's why we went on a family vacation
just
a couple weeks ago. If I could find a good film festival,
any film festivals
in this time,
okay,
that might actually work.
We're going to end up going somewhere really strange now that you opened up that window.
Pensacola.
Let's do
it. Pensacola, Florida.
Let's do it.
I'm sure they have a film festival. That's where we're going next year.
Sounds good.
Hey, this is Mark Duplass, and you're listening to Film Spotting.
Are you an assassin? I'm a soldier. You're neither. You're an errand boy sent by grocery clerks to collect a bill.
This is the end, my only friend, the end of our Sight and Sound Greatest Films of All Time show. Marlon Brando there as Colonel Kurtz from Francis Ford Coppola's Apocalypse Now. There's some very memorable dialogue in voiceover from this film where Martin Sheen is talking about Kurtz, and he says, "I began to wonder what they really had against Kurtz. It wasn't just insanity and murder. There was enough of that to go around for everyone." In some ways, Kurtz strikes me as a character who takes on the characteristics of a martyr. He's someone who Coppola wants to show us as suffering for all of us or for America. And I think all of our picks here encompass key characters who must suffer for others. And Apocalypse Now, of course, is a movie so good. There's a great film about the making of Apocalypse Now. I think that has to tell you something. When I was compiling my notes for these films, for whatever reason, Apocalypse Now ended up being the last film I wrote about. So maybe I was wrestling with it a little bit too much. So I was at my wit's end a little bit. Indulge me a little bit here. Instead of launching into some diatribe explaining why I love this movie, I'm simply going to give you this. Saigon, shit. I'm still only in Saigon. Don't look at the camera. Just go by like you're fighting. Charlie, don't surf. I love the smell of napalm in the morning. Ride of the Valkyries. I'm going to get me some mangoes. Never get off the boat. What are you going to land on? 1/4? 3/8? You're an errand boy sent by grocery clerks to collect a bill. The horror. The horror. That's my abstract defense of Apocalypse Now.
That works. I'll take it.
It works. It's only 4/5 of a great movie, though.
4/5?
Yeah. You don't think the movie dies a little bit when they get upriver?
No.
Not at all?
No.
Not a tiny bit?
It's building towards that.
You don't think any of the endless improvisations feel a little endless toward the end?
Only in the Redux, but yes, not in the original.
I agree with that.
Yeah. I honestly do think it's 4/5 of a great movie, which is great enough.
But those 4/5 are so good.
Fantastic. I mean, I've never seen in a war film or any other kind of film action sequences that were that meticulously and elaborately staged that still managed to hold a shot for 20, 30, 40 seconds with an ungodly amount of explosions and extras. And it just doesn't – nobody makes movies like that anymore. And I'd see it again for a lot of it. But
yeah, if you're going by a genre, this would have to be the war film pick, I feel.
Okay.
But if you're going by director, you got to go with Godfather Part II.
Well, maybe we'll get there. We have some show left.
Okay.
We have some show left there, Michael. Speaking of not making them like they used to, who's your great movie martyr?
My great movie martyr, and I'm not a religious man, but Carl Dreyer's The Passion of Joan of Arc captures what may be the greatest single performance on film, Falconetti's performance of as Joan of Arc. And it's a film I've always said it comes in the late silent era, and because of the way Dreyer bears down on the faces of her accusers and as well as Joan's anguish and finally the sort of ecstatic truth of a death, you might say. It feels like the film was made centuries earlier than film was even invented. That it has that kind of authenticity of texture and fierceness of emotion, and it's a film not enough people have seen, frankly. Mm-hmm. And it's like a lot of silent classics, although it's one of the two or three key ones for me. We have generations coming up now who just simply need to be shown these films or we're all in trouble.
Yeah, the picture really is a parade of faces.
Yeah.
And Falconetti's, above all, is on display for so much of the running time, but it's astonishing how she holds it. It never feels like, oh, we're getting another shot of her face. Not once do you think that because you're so mesmerized.
I'm with you on Falconetti and the greatness of Joan of Arc. Josh, we go from Colonel Kurtz, the madman in the jungle, to Joan of Arc, to a donkey.
A donkey. A donkey I've talked about quite a bit
you
since
have.
Being on the show. We did our Robert Bresson marathon, of course, so Alhazard Balthazar was my pick for best film of that bunch, and I also mentioned it on our 400th live show. This is just a continually fascinating picture to me, no matter how many times I revisit it. It was the one I was most familiar with before the marathon and still held up afterwards as the best example of Bresson's particular style, just that sort of pristine spiritual aura that he brings to his films. I think the reason it continues to resonate, too, is because Balthazar the Donkey can work in so many metaphorical ways. You've got him grouped here with our martyrs, and that's certainly one way you could see him. I talked before about his gaze and how he has this gaze of innocence. And what happens to me when I see this film is I start to see the world through the donkey's eyes, which are sort of these unjudging eyes where people are behaving as if no one is watching throughout the film, yet the donkey's watching. And you turn that inward on yourself, and it can be pretty intense to think about having that gaze cast upon you. Of course, there's the ending, too, which for some inexplicable reason, it's very simple. Not all that much happens cinematically. Something huge, because you've walked alongside this donkey, happens narratively. But it's not really this moment in cinema where you wonder at the techniques being used, yet it still manages to hold up and just packs a wallop every time.
Oh, look! My nose! What's happened?
Perhaps you haven't been telling the truth, Pinocchio.
Perhaps.
Oh, but I have! Every single word!
How about that for an abrupt transition? The ending of Balthazar to the 1940 Disney classic Pinocchio, a little bit of a different tone there with these two films, but we move from martyrs to movies about the truth, or conversely, movies about lies and liars, and Pinocchio is certainly a great place to start, Josh.
Well, one of the essential functions of storytelling since the beginning has been to operate as a morality tale, right? That's how humanity has always used them. Of course, it's been abused, so we think of that term now and we think of these overbearing, preachy films because that's usually what we get. But it's still an essential function. I think Pinocchio serves it well, serves it so artistically. We get Pinocchio and it's this horrifying, it's really almost a cruel exercise in moral instruction for little kids. I mean, kids come out of this thing just terrified. Pinocchio's told by the blue fairy that he'll become a real boy when he proves to be brave, truthful, and unselfish. And then the movie sends him through a trial that's going to test all of these qualities. And along the way, of course, we get this astonishing display of Disney's artistry. Just a few examples would be the puppets of Stromboli, the psychedelic debauchery of Pleasure Island, whatever is going on
that
there.
That is truly terrifying.
It is. And then, of course, there's the overwhelming Monstro. So this endlessly inventive animation, as well as the overall air of fairy tale wonder that still permeates all the horror, it prevents these lessons, of which there are many, from ever really becoming overbearing.
I think ideally you'd live half your life in Pleasure Island and the other half in Pottersville from It's a Wonderful Life after the downfall.
Yeah. Where
the jazz bows have taken
That should
over.
Be a Disney ride.
I think it should. You know, Pinocchio had me right up until Geppetto set up shop in a whale. That's where it lost me.
Then you're like, all plausibility is gone here.
I could go with the blue fairy.
Oh,
I could go with the boy talking and running around and trying to go to school, but
that was just too much.
No, the workshop down there, the lamp.
But here's another example.
Belly of the whale.
When you talk about like naked and obvious artistic pretension, Disney the same year released Fantasia, which really was, you know, just a bald faced effort to kind of tone things up into high art, And the same year you get Pinocchio, which was scarcely less ambitious and artistic, but it's
not on the surface, not as showy. You
know? Infinitely the greater film and probably Disney's masterwork, I'd say. Good pick.
It is a good pick. Michael, your choice for a movie that deals with the truth or certainly a lot of deception going on in your movie.
It's Max Ophüls' The Earrings of Madame De, .. And I came to Ophüls rather late, and I'd seen other similarly inclined stylists who were working in Hollywood, although Ophüls also worked in Hollywood for part of his career. Vincent Minnelli was one of my favorite directors, works the camera in similarly swirling, kind of waltzing ways. And I love how Ophüls lets the camera be a dance partner to the action, not just simply recording it and not leaving all the effects simply to the editing room, but really finding ways to kind of make a screen image dynamic and fluid and ever-changing. And just in a simple story, this tragicomic roundelay that begins with a woman who's selling a pair of earrings for money and sort of this really ironic series of domino effects over the story where you have misunderstandings and then eventually a love affair.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to spoil it for people who haven't seen it. It's a film that really is as beautiful as any I know, and it's a great object. This is a film I would show prospective film students and directors just to simply remind people that, you know, don't just make your movie move in the editing room, or the modern day equivalent of the editing room, which is the iPad, whatever. You know, move the camera in ways that will help us get in the story, and that's what Ophüls will always be the paragon of.
Yeah, and if you watch the DVD release of it, Paul Thomas Anderson actually does the introduction for the film and focuses on how wonderful the long takes are that Ophüls employs in this film. And it makes perfect sense if you enjoy as well Paul Thomas Anderson's movies. You can see that influence in the way he uses the camera. I'm with you.
Yeah, and you don't look at Paul Thomas Anderson's work and think those really amazing, long, showy, long takes like you can see in Love and something like the opening, Welles' opening in Touch of Evil, which is just this bravura, you know, just mm-hmm. completely attention-getting, you know, 5-6-7 minute sequence. Anderson doesn't call attention to the fact that he hasn't broken the take yet.
Yeah,
but the fact that he's actually worked out the blocking mm-hmm. of actor and frame and image and movement. It is a vanishing pleasure, and I'm so thrilled that anyone who discovers The Earrings of Madame De and Ophüls' work in general kind of gets at least mm-hmm. a taste of what that cinematic beauty can mean.
Yeah, I think with Anderson, I guess you could debate how showy it is, but I think of a sequence like when he follows William H. Macy into the party in Boogie Nights. One of those sequences I think could be seen as a little ostentatious, but the fact is I don't think it draws too much attention to itself, and I think it fits in nicely with what we're saying about Ophüls. We actually have been talking about this, Josh, and we might as well announce it here because Ophüls for us is a real blind spot, and this is a fantastic movie. And we've actually decided that as we look at our next marathons, we've had it planned that we're going to explore the genre of blaxploitation. That's one we feel like we've overlooked a little bit and need to learn more about. And after doing Robert Bresson, after doing contemporary Iranian cinema, we need to lighten the mood just a little bit. So not only are we going to do blaxploitation, we're then going to catch up on all the Marx Brothers films
see. They made 13 features and 6 of them aren't worth watching.
Well, we'll find a way to fit in those four or five.
Don't make people watch those things.
You're questioning our Marx Brothers selection.
Change your plans.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Maybe we'll skip the Marx Brothers and we'll go right to Max Ophüls, which is what we're planning to do.
I'm so late to Ophüls, I've not come yet to see anything of his. So I'm looking forward to that. I don't know. I feel like we have to do Marx Brothers, though, because I tried Duck Soup once.
Yeah.
Oh.
And I
know.
Really? I don't feel like I can truly say what I want to say about it until I try it again. And I think a marathon would be fair.
You know what? Have you seen Monkey Business?
No, that's the first I saw.
That's
there,
a very good introduction. That's for someone who's really brand new to the Marx Brothers. Monkey Business might be kind of the softer landing, and it's got a lot of the same completely anarchic appeal. It also runs the same, you know, typical pre-code length of 68, 72 minutes, whatever it is. I don't know. I love that film.
We'll get Michael as our official recommender.
Yeah, I think I'll have to come
marathon.
On for that
he
marathon.
Can be our consultant.
I like it. I like it a lot. Well, my selection for a movie about truth, I think, has to be the all-time best movie about truth, and that is Akira Kurosawa's Rashomon. This was hard. It's always hard when we're talking about great filmmakers. We've noted some of these challenges that we've had throughout making our list, but there are so many good Kurosawa films. It was very hard for me not to put Ron on this list, but I think Rashomon is one that really stands out for me as a masterpiece, maybe his greatest achievement. It was obviously a hugely influential film in terms of it being nonlinear and seeing how many filmmakers have latched onto that. The only real facts we know from this story is that a bandit, a bad guy, has sex with. He rapes a woman out in the forest, and her husband is killed. Everything else after that is in dispute. It varies from story to story. We see the different perspectives of the story, the same incident play out from those different perspectives. And it's a crime at its core, of course, and there's a lot to parse as we try to understand what really happened. But the larger mystery that Kurosawa's interested in is man's inhumanity to man and our capacity to remain hopeful, I think, in a world where horrible acts like this are committed. And I know that some people think actually there's a little bit of a happy ending tacked on to Rashomon, and it's a fair case to make. But for me, it's fitting with Kurosawa's work. This isn't a film that's just about the subjective nature of truth and how participants in the same event can experience it and remember it differently. In each one, we also see the ease with which we can deceive ourselves. We can rationalize, prop ourselves up. In every case, the person telling the story emerges as the most honorable in their version of events. And even in one situation, the impartial observer indicts all of them, says they're all guilty of something. Nobody is spared. And I love the way Kurosawa uses the camera here. When the movie starts at the Rashomon gate, it's very still. It's just capturing the action. And then as we get out with these people in the forest, it really springs to life with the characters and finds a way to reflect the point of view of each of the people telling the story. So for me, Rashomon is not only the champion of movies about truth, it's one of my 10 favorite films.
Hmm. I mean, it's a crazy cultural generalization, but it's ridiculous we haven't even talked about Ozu yet.
True.
Something like the Tokyo Story, which in its own way deals a lot with people trying to find a way to navigate their domestic lives and how much truth can people handle and as parents grow older. And I love that film. And that's a film I haven't seen in long enough. I did Rashomon when it came around again in that excellent new print a few years ago. Really, really was a reawakening. And that's a justly influential pick.
I think when I saw it a few years ago, it was probably the same print. I realized for all its influence in so many ways, it also influenced the recent rash of Japanese horror, at least of the last maybe 5-10 years in some of the imagery. If you think about the medium that's used at one point in the film and how I think is it the slain husband's testimony,
right,
that's given through?
Yeah.
And that character is so spooky, and you can see some of the echoes of the same imagery we've been getting in the last 5-10 years.
You are ugly enough. Don't stare at me. The evil eye doesn't work on me.
Mother, sister, you've been talking about me for 18 years. What have I ever done to you?
You a drunk fool.
Besides that, the mayor don't bother nobody. And nobody don't bother the mayor. But you, the mayor just tend to his own business. I love everybody. I even love you.
Hold your tongue. You don't have that much love.
One day, you're going to be nice to me. We may both be dead and buried, but you're going to be nice, at least civil.
Let me tell you the story of Right Hand, Left Hand. It's a tale of good and evil. And these three movies, closing out our list of the 10 greatest films ever, all show characters making really difficult moral and ethical choices, or in some way explore the concept of justice, somehow ending with movies about the truth and movies about justice and morality, right and wrong, seem to me the best way to close out these lists. Josh, why do you love Do the Right Thing?
This is the film that the Sight and Sound Top 10 most desperately needs, I feel, because of all the usual suspects that are mentioned, and sometimes you'll see the same titles filter back and forth, Do the Right Thing is great in the most unique way compared to any of those. It's absolutely in your face, of course. That's the way Spike Lee works. It doesn't downplay or soothe the racial tension on display. And some find that style off-putting. Even if they agree with the message, they still find the style off-putting. But I see it as a necessity. Sometimes if you're saying something the majority doesn't want to hear, you're going to have to scream. But I think the point is that Lee does scream very artfully. One example would be the famous montage of various characters spewing epithets directly toward the camera. It's one of the true jolts of the cinema. Despite all this anger and offensiveness, though, I do always find when I watch Do the Right Thing again, I find it to be a cathartic experience. I think part of that is because of this honesty that I'm talking about. But it's also that there's some humanity there. Mm-hmm. There is this searching for connection that the movie, despite all the screeching, makes room for. You see it in Lee and Rosie Perez's midday tryst, and you also see it in Ossie Davis wooing Ruby Dee throughout, which we heard a little bit of. So the movie suggests that just about everyone on this block where the movie is set is deserving of dignity, but I think it stings, and it has that lasting sting because Lee chooses to chronicle the tragedy that ensues when nobody's given it.
Yeah, it's certainly a key film of the 1980s, and I'd be hard-pressed to think of another American film from the same decade that would deserve a place on anybody's list higher than that.
I'm with you.
I'm a little disheartened that Lee hasn't come up nearly as high since, but maybe that's what anybody who comes up with something approaching a masterwork has to contend with a lot of their careers afterwards.
Yeah, it's a heavy weight to bear. That is one of your early films.
Well, Michael, for your final selection, I had to stretch the theme of the category just a little bit because I don't think this is a movie anyone thinks of primarily as being about justice or key moral and ethical decisions. At the same time, that is a major plot point in this film. And anyone who has been listening to the show regularly for the past 6 months or so knows that this is a beloved film of yours.
Oh, I adore this. It's about moral and ethical decisions and how to duck them when you have a job to do. And it's His Girl Friday, which is the Howard Hawks screen adaptation of the Hector MacArthur newspaper comedy, The Front Page. It's one of my favorite Hawks films. Hawks is one of my favorite directors. In a way, that's why it's there, period. It's also my favorite Cary Grant performance ever, which perfectly blended his leading man and his low comedian. I love the fact that it is so intensely verbal that they managed to get almost all of a three-hour play done in about 88 minutes or whatever the running time is. And I just find that kind of fast talk and anarchic, crazy, morally discomforting insanity, just the most bracing tonic. I wish the movies knew how to talk like that mm-hmm. still, and they don't. They know how to yell, and they know how to swear, and they know, and now and then you get a sense of somebody knowing how to pace and build a dialogue-driven scene in a comedy properly. And it's also got my favorite single shot in cinema, which is that great dolly shot of all the old-fashioned telephones ringing just before the reporters rush back in the room.
And, yeah, it really puts them in that space and shows her comfort in that space.
Yeah,
Hildy's,
I love it. Yeah, I know.
Joy
Rosalind,
being there.
Rosalind Russell, you know, every inch as good as Cary Grant.
Oh, no, Mama doesn't dream about you anymore, Wally. You wouldn't know the old girl now.
Yes, I would. I'd know you anywhere.
You're repeating yourself, Walter. That's the speech you made the night you proposed.
Yeah, I know that you still remember it.
Of course I remember it. If I didn't remember it, I wouldn't have divorced you.
The first 10 minutes of His Girl Friday, to me, is an object lesson on how to, you know, introduce characters, establish a premise, make them equally smart and quick-witted wiseacres. And I think these days screenwriters make it too easy on themselves. It's easier to write jerks and idiots who don't know much, who are just kind of, you know, straw figures to be knocked down by the heroes or heroines. And here, almost everybody's got an angle and something to say and a great way to say it. I love this film.
I went to the police like a good American. These two boys were brought to trial. The judge sentenced them to 3 years in prison and suspended the sentence. They went free that very day. I stood in the courtroom like a fool. And those two bastards, they smiled at me. Then I said to my wife, for justice, we must go to Don Corleone.
Well, Michael, you said it should be another Francis Ford Coppola film that made this list instead of Apocalypse Now, The Godfather 2. How about The Godfather instead? That's the movie about huge moral and ethical choices and justice that I'm going with instead. And I had to play that opening scene. For justice, we must go to Don Corleone. How great is that sequence? I Believe in America, Bonacera, the Undertaker, in black, barely any light revealing his face. Gordon Willis's stunning cinematography is something to watch. And the slow reveal, the slow pullback, long take, revealing just a little bit more as the scene plays out, showing the Godfather in profile. And I love the great trick Coppola pulls on us there, where we see Bonacera come over to whisper into the Godfather's ear, and we see it all happening with the Godfather in profile. It's right in front of us. They're whispering right in front of us, but we can't hear what he's saying to him. And there's that seemingly endless pause, Marlon Brando as Vito, pondering his response, and he simply says, "That I cannot do." This is a movie that, ironically, I think, AMC always chooses to run at Thanksgiving. Have you noticed that? It's about the family, and you're with your family, so let's show The Godfather. And I've always thought that's a little bit amusing, but I'm hooked every single time it comes on at Thanksgiving. I watch the entire saga. Well, not the entire saga. I don't watch The Godfather 3.
Please, please.
You can point, though, to so many bravura sequences, just like that opening one where Coppola puts the camera in really interesting places. The composition, the lighting are wonderful. But the fact is that there isn't a dramatic cinematic arc that I find more fascinating than Michael Corleone's. And it's hard to choose The Godfather over The Godfather 2. It really is, because that arc is also something. But to watch Michael go from, "It's my family, Kay, it's not me," to having his hand kissed at the end of The Godfather 1 is the one that hooks me the most. And every time I see it, something subtle comes out. Something more is revealed. I think about the hospital scene where the men are coming to kill his father, and he's all alone. And Michael tells him, "It's okay, I'm with you now." And of course, he's there with him. He means it literally, "I'm there with you." But on a grander scale, that's the moment where he is finally with the family, where he becomes a full-fledged member of this family. And Brando's face, you can't really tell. Is he smiling? Is he crying? Is this a moment of some joy or a moment of despair that the thing he never wanted to happen for Michael is actually happening? It's probably a little bit of both. And the way he recruits Enzo the baker to stand out there as a bodyguard with him, the thing that I noticed the last time that I'd never really paid attention to before was the moment as they're waiting for the men to show up, and it's a very tense scene. Enzo's really nervous, and he tries to light a cigarette, and he can't light it because his hands are shaking too much. And Pacino just grabs the lighter and flicks it, and it comes right on, and he shuts it. And there's this just quick pause where Coppola just lingers on Pacino as he seems to recognize, "I have this under control." It's this moment where he almost just seems to come to terms with the fact that he can handle this, that this is where he belongs in some way, that this is what he's made for, this kind of cold-blooded, just business world, and he can handle that perfectly. He's so calm and capable, and he's going to do whatever it takes to protect his family. So The Godfather, for me, had to be on this list. As much as I love The Godfather 2, I don't know, something about the elegance of Michael's arc. I guess that's the reason why it stands out for me, is not necessarily the superior film, but the one I'm going with for this list.
Well, you can't, yeah, honestly, you can't look at the second one without talking about the first one,
right?
Because it's such an achievement that Coppola was able to, in my view, transcend the first one with the second one. It's the second one is longer. It's got that, you know, very tricky flashback structure. But the reason I love the second one so much is that it finds a way to kind of make the audience eat it a little bit. You know, the first film had this irresistible romanticized view of the American, you know, gangster.
Yeah.
And it's so much great popular art in so many cultures is all about just transcending the boundaries of a genre. You know, Hamlet is just a revenge tragedy.
Mm-hmm.
And Hamlet managed to kind of elevate it to a level that just where all the plays it's imitating, we don't know, and we know Hamlet. The Godfather is head and shoulders above 99.9% of everything that came before it. And it's certainly the equal and maybe the better, the greater film to the equivalent of some of the great things from the early 30s era.
Mm-hmm.
that got the movies in love with gangsters in the first place. But A Godfather 2, to me,
it's more complex.
It's more complex.
It's some
more,
richer
it's
elements.
It's more
there.
Novelistic, but I also think it's tougher on the Michael Corleone character.
For sure.
I think, and that's why I love it. I think it gives the audience more things to really wrestle with, and frankly, rethink about why they loved the film the first. I don't know. I was surrounded by people in high school who just, especially Italian American kids I went to high school with, who, you know, their families embraced that film like no other they had ever known. It was just like finally a movie about us,
right?
And, you know, we are the heroes of this story.
Yeah.
And, troubling in some ways in that they kill and, you know, they're not honest and, you know, they're not really legal. But The Godfather 2 just takes all that and kind of doesn't explode it and doesn't undermine it, but it really amplifies it.
Well, I can't tell you how close I came to putting them both on my list. I was going to follow the Sight and Sound rules up until 2012. They'd allowed voters to merge them together.
Which is crap.
So it is.
Cheating.
Even though it's right in my wheelhouse and something I would do, of course. I would love to merge those two films together. And it was always in the top 10. And then this year they said, no, you have to pick them separately. And it's worth noting, for whatever reason, they dropped out. I think The Godfather 1 was still higher, maybe at 21. And The Godfather Part 2 was 31. I have a feeling that if they still allowed them to join them together, they'd be in the top 10. But that is cheating because you're taking two masterpieces and merging them together. Of course, those two films may stand above one other great film, but that really was the biggest thing I wrestled with, was whether or not I could justify putting two Godfather films on my list. They both certainly deserve to be in the top 10.
I think there's a very good reason this plays on Thanksgiving, actually, is because, this is a gangster picture, but it's also a business movie, right? It's essentially about creating and protecting your own business in this country. And what are the majority of our businesses? Our family businesses, right? So the small family business person can watch this movie as a pretty potent metaphor. And if you want to do that every year at Thanksgiving, there you go.
I don't like your cynicism, Josh. I don't like it one bit. I guess that actually brings this to a close. Any final closing comments before we move on? Does everyone feel good about their list?
Are we going to get, well, we have to get to 11 to 20,
we're gonna
right?
Get there.
But that, okay.
We're going to get there.
We'll save that.
Those are our top 10 greatest movies of all time. If that didn't satiate you, it clearly didn't satiate Josh. Bonus content will be available through the Film Spotting iPhone and Android apps. We'll discuss in much less detail, our 11 through 20 picks. You can visit iTunes or Amazon's App World to get the app or find more information at filmspotting.net. Also at filmspotting.net, we'll put a link to our complete list and the Sight and Sound results in our show notes.
We do look forward to your feedback, of course. So you can send us your picks or any other comments about the show to feedback@filmspotting.net. You can also leave us a voicemail, 206-203-2463, or find us on Twitter @filmspotting and at facebook.com/filmspotting.
Out wide this weekend, Premium Rush, the new bicycle movie.
Are you excited?
The new thriller with Joseph Gordon-Levitt. I do love Quicksilver.
You love Quicksilver, and you also love, what was the other 80s one you put on our top five
bicycle
scenes?
Wait, the Kevin Bacon Quicksilver?
Yeah, Quicksilver was Kevin Bacon. Breaking Away.
I'm being a little tongue-in-cheek. I do love Breaking Away.
See?
Very different movie.
You better get in line
for
this.
Very different movie, and I love Joseph Gordon-Levitt. Also out, The Apparition and Hit and Run. Michael, have you seen any of those? Do you want to recommend any of those to our audience?
Premium Rush, man.
Really?
Oh, yeah. I
love it.
And
Michael Shannon is a bad guy.
Yeah, and I hate Hit and Run.
Hate it. Okay, well, we'll move on. In limited release, The Imposter, the new Spike Lee movie, Red Hook Summer, Robot and Frank, this is a film starring Frank Langella and Liv Tyler, and also the new David Cronenberg movie, Cosmopolis, which we'll talk about next week on the show. We'll also play my interview with Mike Birbiglia, the writer and director and star of the new movie, Sleepwalk With Me, and another interview. It's a big week for interviews, my conversation with Craig Zobel, the director of the very controversial, divisive Compliance, I think an interesting film to discuss. We'll also share our top five most anticipated fall movies. So it's fall movie preview week on Film Spotting.
Film Spotting is produced by Golden Joe Dassault and Sam Van Halgren. Without Sam and Golden Joe, this show wouldn't go. Thanks to associate producer Candace Griffiths, and special thanks to Tori Malatia and Shauna Coyne at WBEZ. Our featured artist this week was The Gaslight Anthem. You can learn more at thegaslightanthem.com. Michael Phillips, sir, thank you for helping us to carry this load.
Thank you, Josh. Thank you, Adam.
Where can listeners find your stuff?
You can find it, that stuff, at chicagotribune.com/movies.
Of course, we also want to give a big thanks to director Jeff Nichols and all of our guest contributors this week as well. For Film Spotting, I'm Josh Larson.
I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.